an expert. More than you, she fired back. You're the one who ran away from her in the first place.
You came with me, and I was trying to protect her.
Good. Be angry. It will make it easier to take when I...
She shoved the spike into his knee, simultaneously jamming a wooden rod into his mouth. He bit down hard, cutting off a scream. The agony was complete, shooting up his leg, into his torso, his back, his neck. She twisted. He thought he felt a tooth crack as he bit down harder, surprised the rod didn't snap in half between his jaws. He felt something else, like a part of him drifting away, a part of him he'd never wanted.
"Should I stop?"
Faye said, raising her voice so she could be heard. He was growling now, a deep-throated groan.
"No,"
he managed.
"It's working."
Another twist and his vision started to blur, tears bullying their way from his eyes. The monster spoke to him, its voice as clear as he'd ever heard it.
"If you do this, Anise will die."
He felt nothing, the pain obliterated by the statement.
"If you hurt her, not by me, by the Horde. They are too strong, too many. I can fight on my own now. I don't need you." "You are lying to yourself, Taryn. I am your only hope to protect her against what is to come."
Taryn's teeth shaved splinters of wood from the rod clamped between them.
"Anise is a great warrior. She can protect herself, and so can I. It is your choice."
The monster sounded resigned to its fate now. He didn't know if it was right or not. But when it came to Anise, he wasn't willing to take any chances.
"Stop,"
he said, his eyes shooting open and locking on Faye. She withdrew the spike from his knee and he limped out, off to admit everything to Anise. Before he'd gone 5 steps, the city warning bells began clanging. 94. The Northern Kingdom, Gearhead. Anise Garrick. Anise was studying a detailed map of the north when the bells began to chime. She frowned, trying to remember the day. On certain days and times the bells chimed, but never this long or loud. No, this was a warning. She stood quickly. Perhaps the Easterners had taken her request for assistance as a sign of weakness, and were now pouring through Raiders Pass, hell-bent on conquering the north at long last. She refused to consider the alternative, because the Horde couldn't have possibly crossed the frozen tundra so quickly, not even during this warmer part of the year. They still had a few days, maybe more. She crossed the room, poking her head into the corridor, which was full of a stampede of people. She grabbed one by the arm and held tight. The woman looked at her with wide eyes.
"Your Highness, I'm sorry. The bells mean we should go to a safe place. There is a walled-in building. The soldiers will surround it. We are prepared for this, because of our proximity to the front lines."
Anise knew all that, but these were not normal times. Half the city had been evacuated already. The rest of them were preparing to leave, one group at a time to prevent flooding the roads to the east. The woman tried to pull away, but Anise refused to release her.
"Go to the safe place. Tell everyone there that they must leave the city immediately." "But that is an order from your queen. Now go!"
She shoved her away, and the woman scampered off amongst the throng.
"I have to find Taryn," she thought.
Thankfully, he was twice the size and a head taller than anyone else in the city. She spotted him striding up a staircase toward her. His gait was strange, kind of herky-jerky, and blood ran freely down his leg, seeming to originate from his knee.
"What happened?"
she asked.
"Nothing to concern yourself with," he said. "What are the bells about?"
"I don't know yet. The people are reacting like it's an impending attack through Raiders Pass."
"But you don't think that's it?"
She shook her head.
"I'm not certain. That doesn't feel right. All news pointed to an Eastern-Western alliance against Fanes. Attacking us at the same time would be a major risk."
They stared at each other, both thinking the same thing, because there was only one other option.
"We have to find whomever sounded the alarm," Taryn said.
Anise nodded, spinning and leading the way down a corridor, spilling out the front of the castle. The grounds were also in chaos, with horses being saddled and all manner of people, soldiers, lords and ladies, and commoners, flowing into the exodus toward the so-called safe place. Anise felt the urge to head them off, but she needed information first.
"This way," she said, grabbing Terin's hand and pulling him against the flow of traffic.
It took far too long, but she wanted to get to a specific tower, the one that faced west, toward Blackstone. They climbed the steps quickly, and by the time Anise reached the summit she was out of breath, and Terin seemed ready to collapse, clutching his knee. A man stood at the top, his arm moving back and forth wildly, gripping the rope that was clanging the bell.
"Stop!"
Anise commanded, and he whirled around, so surprised by their appearance that the rope slipped from his hand and slapped against his face. The bell continued to ring above him, but then the peal gradually drifted away.
"Your Highness?"
the man said. She strode forward and grabbed him by the collar. She knew she was developing a bad habit, brutalizing her people into obedience. But these were far from ordinary times.
"What did you see?"
The man's eyes told the story. The fear was there, wide and white and impossible to hide.
"They're coming,"
he said, pointing west. The spyglass rested on its stand at a disjointed angle, like it had been thrust aside in a hurry. Anise stepped up to it, closed one eye, repositioned it, and looked through the glass. At first she saw nothing, just spring-green hills and snowy mountains, and she rocked it back to where something different, something other, had caught her eye. They were only specks in the distance, small, dark, and of no concern to a queen.
Frozen hell! They could be rocks revealed by the melting snow.
Except they weren't, Anise knew. And they were moving, the loping, menacing stride evident even from this distance. The Horde had arrived, with her uncle at their helm. This is the end of Book 4, but the story continues with three postlude stories in the Fate-marked epic series. Keep listening after the credits to hear more. You have been listening to Deathmarked, Book 4 of the Fate-marked epic. Produced by Greg Lawrence. Associate Producer Emily Durr. Text copyright 2017 by David Estes. Production copyright 2018 by Podium Publishing. All rights reserved. Postlude 1. Mortis Ironclad. The New World, Night's End. Circa 110. Mortis Ironclad was a simple but proud man. A Crimean by birthright, he hailed from the haunted hills of West Greve, a country of forests and plains in equal measure, where farmers and woodsmen roamed without a care for the wars of kings and queens in faraway lands.
"How am I here?" he wondered, tears dripping from the woodcutter's chin.
He stared at his hands, but didn't recognize them. He couldn't make out the rough patchwork of calluses, nor the long, ragged scar he'd earned when he'd almost chopped off his thumb when he was 16.
"They are the hands of a stranger."
His fingers dripped blood in a greater quantity than the tears. Her blood. It was everywhere. On his skin, puddling on the floor, splashed on the walls and her bed covers.
"Who would do such a thing?"
That question was but distant thunder next to his grief. The grief of a man from Greve. She might have been a doll, her turquoise eyes devoid of the luster they once held, locked in a sightless stare. Her sun-browned skin was a sharp contrast to her sun-streaked hair, that told of long treks from the well to the castle and back again, filling the tubs of the lords and ladies for their daily baths. Already, her skin looked greyer, her lips white, her hair limp and dull. Mortis bit his lip, drawing blood. Slowly, delicately, he offered his arms, wrapping them around her shoulders. He drew her to him, resting her head on his chest. It was why he was here, after all. A clandestine meeting in the dark, their first after a long courtship that had started at a slow simmer, but had seemed ready to boil over on this very night. Now, the pot was empty. Now, covered in the blood of the only woman Mortis had ever loved, he held her broken, lifeless form, and wept. When the castle guards found him, he refused to release her body from his grasp, forcing them to pry his fingers from her one by one by one.
"What have you done?"
one of the guards said. The burly man gripped his arm hard enough to bruise, but Mortis barely felt it.
I...
He had no words, would never have words. How did one speak of a loss so deep? It cut him to the core of a place he'd never known existed until he met her. How did one speak the name of the woman he'd loved for too short a time to quench his thirst, quell his hunger? How did one go on living?
Who did this?
The question was but a distant star next to the grief, which shook his body with another tremor, his vision obliterated by the tears.
Speak!
The guard demanded. The other guard stood back from the growing pool of blood, like touching it might kill them.
I want to go home,
Mortis said, and he didn't mean his small cabin on the outskirts of the castle. He meant the place he was born. He wanted his mother's arms to wrap him up, to hold him. He wanted to hear his father's boots stomping off the dust and pine nettles of a hard day's labor in the woods. His parents had died years earlier, which was part of the reason he was here, in this new world. It was supposed to be a fresh start, an opportunity to build something, to be something. And then he'd met her, and everything else had faded away. 6 months earlier. Scarlet Browning caught Mortis's eye the moment he saw her. It wasn't just her beauty, which was alluringly understated, her bright hair tied in a scarf, her mischievous eyes hidden under a canopy of long, dark lashes. No, it was the way she carried herself and her tubs of water, hefting them from the well to the cart, straight-backed and determined, her jaw jutting out like the cliffs toward the sea.
She doesn't want to be offered help, he thought. She doesn't need it.
Something about that only made Mortis want to help her more. But he fought off the urge, pretending to split logs, but missing his mark badly, and almost splitting his knee wide open.
If a woman should be the death of me, I want it to be this woman, he thought.
Their introduction was beautifully awkward.
Do you need help, woodcutter? She asked, having seen his blunder.
His cheeks heated rapidly, though it was late fall, and the weather was quite cool.
I was going to ask you the same thing, he countered.
Her hands found her hips in a way that caused his heart to beat as fast as if he'd run a great distance. She was a solid woman, unlike most of the dainty ladies that prowled the castle like cats marking their territory.
Do I look like I need help?
Her arms looked strong, her legs stronger. He was certain the rest of her matched her limbs, though she was hidden under thick folds of grey cloth cinched only at the waist.
No. Perhaps.
He was certain other men had withered under the glare she gave him, but he basked in it. This woman could shoot daggers at him all day long, and he wouldn't mind.
I have a proposition, she said. We trade for a time. I chop your wood, and you fill my tubs.
Before he could stop it, a snorted laugh escaped his lips, further stoking the flames licking his cheeks. He opened his mouth to respond, but she was already stalking over to him, reaching out to grab the axe from where he'd left it stuck in the chopping block.
"Step back, lest you're keen to lose a limb," she said, propping the heavy axe on her shoulder with a casualness that suggested experience with such a tool.
He did, in awe of the magical creature standing before him. Her eyes narrowed in concentration, and she used a combination of her legs, arms, and torso to thrust the axe high over her head before bringing it down with a satisfying thunk. Two halves of a split log fell to either side, cut evenly all the way through. He gaped. She didn't gloat, simply set down the axe and placed a new log on the block. That one split as easily as the first, at which point she turned to him and inquired as to whether he needed instructions on filling her tubs.
"I... no," Mortis said, turning toward her cart while fixing her on the edge of his vision, afraid that if he took his eyes off her, she might disappear.
For the next hour he toiled, filling tubs in the well and hefting them onto the cart. More times than he could count, the water sloshed over the sides, drenching him from head to feet, infiltrating even his boots, which caused his toes to squish into his thick knit socks. Halfway along, she finished with the logs, filling his cart to the brim. Then, to his utter delight and dismay, she sat cross-legged on the edge of the wagon to watch him struggle with his task. It wasn't the weight of the tubs that was the problem, though filled to the brim with water they were heavy, but the balance. One had to maintain a steady form to prevent them from spilling. By the end, Mortis had only managed the feat one time out of 24 attempts. The woman clapped long and slow. Despite her mockery, Mortis beamed. When he finished, she stood and offered her hand firmly. "Scarlet Browning," she said. He took her hand, self-conscious of the roughness of his own hand, which was slick with sweat and water, only to find hers equally calloused. "Mortis Ironclad," he said. She nodded once and then turned away, slapping her mule twice on the rump to rouse it from sleep. He watched her go until she was out of sight, before shaking his head in wonderment. They met in the same spot every day after that. When they were finished with their daily toils, they spent more time together. One night, resting on a log outside of Mortis's cabin under a sky full of stars, they kissed. To Mortis, it felt like he was breathing air for the first time. His heart skipped a beat, and he wondered whether it would ever have the same rhythm. He hoped not. They didn't kiss again for a week after that, and Mortis was afraid he hadn't met her expectations. Even more than that, he was afraid the second attempt wouldn't live up to the first. Neither fears were valid, and under a sky of dark clouds pregnant with rain, when their lips touched again, it felt as if the sun had broken through at long last. A slow simmer. The steady, even pace of their romance made it all the sweeter, as their kisses grew longer and more passionate. Each time was like tasting an elixir sweeter than the last. "Come to my hut," she said one evening after they'd eaten together. "Later, when it is dark." The next 2 hours crawled more slowly than any before. Mortis passed the time by selecting his finest boots, trousers and shirt, the only set that weren't worn and full of holes. He shaved his beard, which carried the roughness of a fortnight of growth. He even wet his hair, fighting the unruly spots he typically ignored into submission. His heart was the thunder of an entire company of cavalry riding into battle. He was certain everyone he passed could see the excitement on his face, though the shadows were deep enough to hide such subtleties. When he reached her door, he knocked twice, softly. When there was no answer, he knocked louder. Still, nothing. The night was calm and silent, save for the sound of his own breaths leaving his lips. Something felt off. Wrong. Like the moons had failed to rise, and the stars had winked out. "Scarlet?" he said through the door. "Are you home?" No answer. The windows were dark and shrouded by curtains. Perhaps she fell asleep, he thought. Perhaps I waited too long to come. The answers felt empty and cold. Fear rose in him, and somehow he knew what he would find when he pushed open the door, which was unlocked, shoving in with the slightest of creaks.
"Why, oh, why, oh, why?"
he thought, as the memories faded. Nothing made sense. Who would murder a lady's maid? Who would take a life so beautiful as Scarlet's? The guards hustled him along, cursing each time he stumbled. Try as he might, there was no strength left in his legs, nor his arms. Mortis was a stuffed, life-sized doll shoved hither and thither. Suddenly, they stopped. Mortis saw nothing, felt everything.
"What do we have here?" a voice said. "This is the woodcutter, is it not? Why have you brought him to me? Is that blood?"
The voice was familiar, but not enough to arouse his curiosity. Nothing would ever again. The guard shoved him forward, into a halo of orange light.
"Found him in one of the maid's huts, covered in her blood. He was making a strange sound."
"Wrath?"
"And the maid?" the voice said.
"Dead."
The word fell from the man's lips far too easily, which finally snapped Mortis out of his stupor. His head jerked up, and he saw the man standing before him. Lord Farley Loren was clothed in fine white trousers and a puffy white shirt tied at the front. Black leather boots matched his belt and scabbard, from which hung a longsword. Though he was young to be a lord, his father had died during the War of Independence, leaving responsibility for their house to him. It was generally known that his father had been fleeing the battle rather than running into it when he was struck down by an enemy arrow. The battle was later coined the War of Roses, due to the way the patterns of bloodstains resembled fallen rose petals when viewed from afar. The rumours about his father's cowardliness had left a black stain on the reputation of the Lorens, and Lord Farley had been overcompensating ever since. It was known by many that what he desired most was to wrest control of the colonies from Werner Gehrig, a war hero whose grandfather, Heinrich, was something of a legend, having discovered these very lands. Werner was now an old man and rarely seen, and though he had a son, his son was even more of a recluse. Lord Farley, however, loved to be seen, and was currently serving as captain of the guard for Night's End.
"Did you kill her, woodcutter?" Lord Farley asked.
A white bandage was tight against the skin above his left eye.
"She has a name," Mortis wanted to say. "And so do I,"
though the latter no longer felt true. As for the Lord's accusation, he could only say, "I loved her."
"Should we call upon the Furies?"
one of the guards asked the Lord. Lord Farley seemed to consider the question for a moment before shaking his head.
"No, I shall investigate the matter myself. The truth should be discovered easily enough." The truth. What did the truth matter when she was already lost to him? What would it change?
Mortis felt himself falling down a long, narrow shaft, like the well that Scarlet visited so often. Eventually, he knew, he would reach the bottom with a splash, and then sink, sink, sink. Once more, he was dragged along like a naughty child. All he wanted to do was lie down and fade away. When his fingers moved at his sides, they were sticky with blood. He clamped his eyes shut and tried not to think about it, tried to pretend this was all a dream, a bad, bad dream. A slamming sound jarred his eyes open.
"What are you—"
Slam. The sound reverberated around his skull.
Slam.
One of the guards was kicking in his door. Again, nothing made sense.
Slam!
Until it did.
"Did you kill her, woodcutter?"
the Lord had asked.
"They think I would never hurt her,"
he ground out, surprised his voice still worked, that his lips had the strength to open. But they did have strength, and for the first time since he found her, Mortis felt a new emotion rising to blot out the pain, the sadness. And it was anger.
"Quiet, woodcutter,"
Lord Farley said, nodding to the guard to continue.
"Slam. We shall learn the truth, one way or another." Slam, crash.
The door flew open, the lock splintering the wood, one of the hinges cracking from its mount. The guards went in first, their heads swiveling to and fro, before turning back and beckoning to the prince.
"'Tis empty,"
one said, the man with the bruising grip. That's when Mortis felt the tip of the Lord's blade against his back. He glanced around at the young man and could see the cold calculation in his eyes. A piece of the puzzle fell into place. Something Scarlet had once told him about Lord Farley. She'd sat with her knees pulled up to her chest, her arms wrapped around her legs. She'd had a distant look in her eyes. Mortis had asked her what it was like to serve the wealthy every day.
"It's like being a possession," she'd said. "I'm invisible to the ladies until they need something. But the men, they always see me."
"What do you mean?" Mortis had asked.
"They look at me like they're starving. They undress me with their eyes."
It had startled Mortis, causing the very core of him to rise up in protest.
"They claim to be devout followers of Roth,"
he'd said, his voice rising.
"Do you believe me?"
The question had hung in the air, and Mortis could feel the importance of it. To her. It was important to her.
"Always."
She turned to him and smiled. and then leaned in for a kiss. Normally Mortis would have gladly accepted such a gesture, but not on that night. He'd grasped her chin between both hands instead.
"Have any of them ever touched you?"
Unshed tears had sparkled in her eyes, and she didn't have to answer for him to know. Yes. Perhaps it had been a casual touch, almost made to appear accidental, a grasp, a clutch, a bump. But that didn't change what it had done to her, this strong, proud, beautiful woman. She looked scared and violated.
"Who?"
Mortis had growled. She'd shaken her head.
"It doesn't matter."
"It matters to me."
"I know,"
she'd said, clutching his hand in hers.
"And that's why I love you."
No matter how hard he'd tried to learn which of the lords in the castle had been harassing her, she'd refused to answer. Now he knew why. She was afraid of what Mortis might do. Because it wasn't just any of the lords. It was the most powerful of them all. Lord Farley. His sadness didn't vanish so much as get pushed to the bottom of a cauldron boiling over with his rage.
"What did you do?"
he said, his eyes locked with the lord's steely stare. Such insolence could get a man locked in the dungeons, but Mortis was beyond caring, far beyond.
"Nothing," Lord Farley said with a smug smile. "It's you who did something."
At that same moment, one of the guards yelled, "We found something, my lord." Mortis stared at the lord, whose sword arm hadn't wavered in the slightest. With the tiniest bit of pressure, he could run steel through Mortis's body. He could take away the pain, the anger, the life that no longer felt worth living. He didn't, at least not yet.
"Go inside and face the truth,"
Lord Farley said. Mortis considered attacking the lord. Why not? He had nothing more he could lose. But first he needed to know what they'd found. He marched into the cabin that no longer felt like his, but the home of a stranger. Everything inside was his. The carvings of animals on the walls, a hobby of his. The old battered pots and pans drying on the rack. The too small bed in the corner, its covers yanked back by the soldiers. But he no longer cherished any of it. And his axe.
His axe.
A woodcutter cared for their axe like a mother for a child. He sharpened it daily, oiled it before bed. Replaced the wooden handle whenever it became overly notched. Placed it in its rack, where it was now. Beneath it was a dark puddle. Small drips fell from the blade from time to time, splashing, causing tiny ripples to appear.
No.
Everything was worse now. He could hardly bear the knowledge that she was gone, but to know it had been his axe. The very same she'd handled so expertly on the day of their first meeting. It broke something in him. If he was angry before, he was livid now. A pinprick in his back, the pressure of a meaningless blade wielded by a pathetic man who'd taken everything from him. He took a step forward, and the blade at his back followed. "Arrest this man," Lord Farley said. The guard stepped forward. There were two ways to play this. Allow himself to be arrested, tried, and executed. Or fight now and die. The lord seemed to sense his intention.
"Don't," he said. "I won't hesitate."
Mortis dropped to his knees.
"Good," the lord said. "It is better this way."
Mortis closed his eyes, fighting off the images that assaulted him. The prince's subtle gropes and grabs, first Scarlet's bottom, then her breasts. Maybe she'd snapped at him, told him to sod off. It was something she would do. She wasn't a woman to be trifled with. He could see the lord laughing it off in that devil-may-care way of his. He could see her fiery nature only making him more determined.
"What did you do to her?"
he whispered.
"What was that, woodcutter?"
Mortis didn't need an answer. Lord Farley had gone to her that night. She'd opened her door, expecting Mortis. He'd forced his way inside. He'd forced himself upon her. She would have resisted. He would have hit her, tried to subdue her, but she was no easy prey. She would have scratched and clawed and...
the bandage above his left eye. "You're a murderer," Mortis said.
"The evidence tells a different tale," the Lord said. The guards were close now, their bootfalls vibrating the floor just beyond.
"I demand a fair trial," Mortis said. "You will get one, though it won't change the outcome."
Rough hands on him, dragging him to his feet. The clink of iron manacles being prepared. The swell of his lungs as he heaved in a breath.
"I will not go quietly."
His shoulders sagged, as they might expect, because he was broken, defeated. Or so they thought. Suddenly he surged forward, his eyes flashing. One of the guard's grips was broken, while the other managed to hang on to his wrist. He whipped his freed hand around, slamming his fist into the second guard's nose. Mortis was strong from cutting and hauling wood day in and day out. The guard sank like a dropped stone. Lord Farley was shouting something, though the words were meaningless to Mortis, because instead of whirling to face the other guard, he dove for his axe, clutching the familiar handle like an old friend, swinging it around with precision, steel flashing. It sunk deep into the guard's chest, his eyes widening, his mouth bursting open with a gasp. The guard's own weapon, which was now clutched in his hand, slipped from fingers sapped of all strength. The Lord of House Loren stared at him, his smug expression gone. His grip tightened on his sword, but Mortis didn't fear it. Though the prince had been trained as a master swordsman from birth, his own pain would more than make up the difference. The Lord seemed to realize the same, because he turned tail and fled. Mortis charged out into the night, but swiftly realized he could not catch him. Mortis was a larger man, not fleet of foot, while the Lord was slender and lithe, and came from a family of runners. By the time Farley reached the castle doors, the odds would be greatly stacked against Mortis. He longed to go to her, to Scarlet, to hold her, to give her the final rest she deserved. "But then you will be found and executed."
"I will kill them all."
"That's impossible. And the one you want vengeance on most won't come anywhere near you."
"I can't leave her."
"It's what she would want."
"What would she want?"
The answer to his internal debate came as pure and clear as a bright morning sunbeam.
"She would want you to live."
He ran. He used the small wooden door in the castle wall that was for him, leading into the forest. How often had he passed through this door to fell trees, cutting them into sections and hauling them into the castle to be split into firewood for the lords and ladies. As he plunged through the darkness, branches whipping across his face, slashing his skin, he wondered how many of those logs had warmed Lord Farley's bedchamber. The desire to go back and seek vengeance rose again like a dark tide, but he swallowed it down. Scarlet wouldn't want that. It was that truth that drove him onwards, until his strength faltered under the powerful weight of grief pressing down upon his shoulders. He collapsed, his entire body shaking, barely noticing the sharp thorns and stones piercing his clothes and skin. Sounds emerged from his throat he didn't know he was capable of forming. Animal sounds, gurgles and croaks, and groans and growls. His face was wet. His hands were crusted with blood.
"My axe," he thought,
realizing he was no longer carrying it. Somewhere along the way, he'd dropped his only weapon. He curled his knees to his chest, holding them tight, like a newborn babe trying to recreate the comfort of sleeping in the womb. The tears stopped as he rocked back and forth. Finally, he stopped moving. Finally, he slept. Mortis awoke to the sound of dogs barking. He squinted, though it wasn't bright in the forest, the thick leafy canopy blocking out the early morning sunlight. "Where am—" Bile rose in his throat, memories flashing.
"Oh, Roth. Oh, Scarlet."
He swallowed the bitterness, trying to think. The sounds of the dogs were still distant, but he knew they would get closer quickly as they tracked his scent. He could lay here and let them find him. At the least, they could make his pain go away forever.
"Pain is what reminds us that we're alive."
His entire body jolted, as if she had whispered in his ear, her breath hot on his skin. But no, it was just a warm breeze, and the voice was in his mind, a memory of something Scarlet had once said to him. A large splinter had broken from her cart and pierced her skin. Mortis had removed it for her, warning her that it would hurt. That's how she had responded, gritting her teeth as he'd used a heated pin and tweezers to remove it. She hadn't so much as whimpered, though she'd released a sharp breath when he'd finished.
"I am alive. I am living for her now."
The thought gave him strength enough to push to his feet. His body ached. Dried blood trickled from a dozen puncture wounds. He plucked out the thorns and nettles, tossing them aside. The baying of the dogs was closer now. He ran, his mouth dry, his stomach empty and hungry. Water, he thought. Not to drink, but to cross. It was the only way he'd be able to mask his scent from the trackers. Mortis knew these woods inside and out, as he'd traipsed far and wide searching for the best wood for his carvings. There were numerous streams and creeks, but the largest ran from north to south. To the north, it eventually widened into a sizable river, before meandering east toward the thriving colony of Bethany, which lay under the shadow of the mournful mountains. Mortis wondered whether he could hide there, whether he could start a new life with a new name. It was a fool's dream, he knew. The Lord would hunt him to any of the new settlements. From Talis in the south to Restor along the western road. Anywhere he went, he would be hunted, including Bethany. Which left several options. The least expected direction would be south, where skirmishes with the natives in the empires of Fanes and Calip were common. It was said the border colonies were more like ghost towns these days, their refugees tramping down grass and flower as they retreated across the forbidden plains, seeking protection. No, he couldn't go there, which meant certain death. North was an option, but the frozen mountains and tundra were unforgiving during the warmest of seasons, and in winter they were deadly. Though temperatures were cooler in Crimea than in Night's End, Mortis had not seen snow in years. No, north was too great a risk. Which left east. Already rumors had been circulating of explorers and colonists fording the Spear, the largest river in the lands, separating the west from the east. At least one colony had sprung up out of nothing on the river's eastern bank. It was called Portage. Surely Lord Farley wouldn't pursue him that far. All these thoughts passed through Mortis's mind in a few moments as he wound his way through the thick undergrowth and tightly packed trees. It felt good to have a direction, something to run toward, rather than the ghosts he was running from. The baying of the hounds, however, grew ever closer, more frenzied now that they sensed their prey was within range. "Where is it?" Mortis thought, expecting to see the burbling brook around each tree, past each gnarled hedge. He looked back and thought he saw the flash of fur, but it might have been his imagination. Climbing a tree would buy him time, but then what? For one, he was no climber, and two, he would be stuck without food nor water. His pursuers would chop down the tree or set fire to it. She would want you to live. It was that thought, that belief, that pushed strength into his weary legs. He ran faster, hurdling mossy logs and ducking under low-hanging branches as he continued to swivel his gaze back and forth until there. Like the blaze of a lightning strike in the dark of a stormy night, the ever-moving waters of the stream came into view, winding their way through the forest. He half-jumped, half-stumbled down the shallow embankment, plunging his boots into the brook, which, this time of year, rose only knee-high. A small blessing, which allowed him to run not across the water, but along it. The hounds would track his scent to the water's edge, and then their masters would naturally begin searching directly across on the opposite bank. Going downstream would be easier, but his pursuers might assume the same. Mortis headed upstream, shoving through the water with his boots, oblivious to the chilly water filling them, pushing between his toes, like it had the first day he met Scarlet, when he'd spilled so much water on himself. Rounded rocks rolled and shifted under his trod, but he managed not to fall, his arms extended to either side for balance. He glanced back, once, twice. Nothing. He could still hear the hounds, but they had not yet reached the stream, which, just ahead, curved to the right and out of sight. More determined than ever, he fought against the brisk current, more jogging than wading now. He almost stumbled, but maintained his footing. and then he was around the bend, just as he heard the barking reach a crescendo and a male shout spill out from the forest. It made him want to freeze. He did not, taking advantage of every second and driving further upstream. The water level rose until it was waist-high, but he soldiered on, relishing the scent-masking fluid. Every now and then he scooped handfuls into his mouth, quenching his thirst. It did little for his hunger, but that could be dealt with when the imminent danger had passed. The sounds of pursuit grew more distant with every step, every bend in the stream, which was quickly becoming a river. When the last yips faded beyond hearing, Mortis finally dragged himself from the water, soaked to the skin, his heart still pounding, but slower than before. It was no time to grow complacent. The trackers would split up, each following the river with the hounds in a different direction. Eventually, his scent would be discovered again. He considered that truth, and then plunged back into the water, which seemed colder now. He crossed over and used protruding roots to clamber up the steep embankment on the western side. It was what they would least expect. From there, he raced along the river's edge. Thankfully, the forest wasn't as thick here, and he made better time, winding his way through a place that felt like home again. His sanctuary. He'd built a life within its bounds, and now it was saving him. But do I want to be saved? He fought off the thought, but it continued to swell within him, his only companion. Live for her. Live for her. Live for her. He realized he'd been speaking aloud the entire time, repeating the three words over and over like a chant. He didn't stop, couldn't stop. The words driving him toward something he couldn't yet visualize. When his mouth grew dry, he drank. When his stomach growled, he growled back at it. When his legs grew weary, he stopped to rest them briefly before continuing his flight. Distance was his only hope, and even hounds needed to sleep sometime. He didn't stop until he could no longer see where to place the next step, fearing he'd fall headlong into the river and drown. He slept where he fell, covering himself with fallen leaves and dirt. Sleep took him almost immediately, but not before he saw her face. The next day brought sounds of birds chirping and leaves rustling and waters burbling. No baying hounds, no shouting men. He was shivering from the cold, but almost laughed. He'd done it. Somehow, some way, he'd escaped. Mortis peeled off his shirt and wrung out what was left of the moisture. Then he did the same with his pants, laying them out to dry in a patch of sunlight warming of broad, flat rock. His boots were next, and when he turned them upside down, it created a waterfall. It had been foolish to sleep with them on the night before, but he'd been too exhausted to care. His socks were like leeches stuck to his skin, sopping, and when he dragged them off, they revealed pale, wrinkled toes that were more like salted slugs. They went beside his other clothes, as did his undergarments. Naked, he basked in the sun, ignoring the hunger pangs continuing to rumble within him. Eventually, however, he could ignore them no longer, his stomach feeling like a shrunken water skin, aching with need. Careful not to dash his bare feet on a stone or step on any thorns, he foraged for roots and berries. He found a brickleberry bush, but the pink berries were unripe and bitter, several months from the red sweetness that made for his favorite kind of pie. Still, they were better than nothing, and he chewed them until his mouth felt numb, forcing himself to swallow each half-chewed bite. He also managed to scrounge in the dirt for some edible mushrooms, though they were shriveled and did little to satisfy his hunger. He was still searching when a sound made him freeze, goose pimples rising on the back of his neck. The hounds were back. He dragged on his half-dry pants and shoved his feet into his boots, scooping up his socks, undergarments, and shirt, tucking them under one arm. And then he ran. He didn't return to the water, fearing the hounds would catch up as they ran along the embankment. At first he stuck to the water's edge, but the barks grew louder, closer, and he knew he would be caught. Do they have my scent, or are they seeking it? If they were on the western side, then they had picked up his trail, and the only option was to dive back into the water. But if they were on the eastern side... Relying on nothing but instinct, he made a decision, departing from the river and tiptoeing back into the forest, careful not to step on leaf or branch. The dogs had other ways of finding him than their noses. When he was a fair distance from the stream, but still within sight, he stopped and crouched behind the trunk of a large tree. He wrapped his shirt around his shoulders and torso like a shawl, and peeked out. For a while all he heard were the dogs, but then a voice, barely audible over the hounds.
"This is pointless. He's gone."
Mortis slid fully behind the tree when the speaker came into view, but not before he caught a glimpse. There were five, maybe six, hounds tethered together, their leashes connected to a longer rope which was gripped by the first man. From a distance, it was hard to make out any details, but it was clear he wore light armor but no helmet. A response from another man.
"Farley'll have our hides if we return empty-handed."
Mortis's heart beat steadily in his chest, ignoring the urge to look again.
"They don't have my trail," he thought,
which meant they were still on the opposite side. But if they called off the search now and crossed back over the river, the dogs would find him in short order. His heart began to race, his mind churning through his chances, which were slim. More grumbling from the first.
"Shut your yapping," the second man said.
Mortis chanced another look, spotting both men between the trees as they moved further along the opposite edge of the river. There were no others.
"Only two," he thought. "I could kill them."
A laugh almost slipped from his lips, but he clamped them tight together. Yes, he had killed a man for the first time the night before, but that didn't make him a killer. He was weaponless and outnumbered, and the fires that had stoked his prior actions had long faded into the shadows of his heart. Plus, they had the dogs, which would rip him to shreds. No, fighting would be a last resort. Eventually the first man will win the argument. They will cross over. They will take the path of least resistance, heading back downstream. They will pick up my scent. There was nothing for it. As soon as the sounds of the hounds vanished again, he slipped through the forest and into the water. This time, however, he held his clothes and boots above his head, saving him from another frigid, sleepless night. Mortis never saw his pursuers again, and after three more days in the forest, he finally admitted to himself that he was safe. It was a feeling that held mixed emotions for him, because he had failed to keep her safe, because he wasn't sure he deserved safety. But such feelings were counterproductive, and Mortis managed to place them in an iron box, which he locked and hid, to be opened and examined another time. Instead, his focus went to survival. He wasn't willing to risk a fire yet, so he stuck to foraging, finding several mealy apples and some acorns that were so hard he had to grind them into powder between two stones in order to chew and swallow them. The days passed in a blur of unsatisfying meals and aching muscles, his feet growing ever more calloused. And then, one day, he reached the end of the forest, the rolling green hills marching all the way to the sea to the north, and to the great forest known as the Tangle to the east. Connecting the two were the snow-capped Mournful Mountains, the barrier to the north. Somewhere in their shadow lay Bethany, which supposedly bore a population in excess of 2,000 souls now, though more and more colonists were flocking to the village in hopes of finding their fortune. It was said a castle was even being built, and that one of the wealthy houses of Knight's End had already won the bidding.
"I cannot go there," Mortis thought.
"I cannot go anywhere. Except perhaps east." It was this thought, this hope, that helped him put one foot in front of the other, though they felt like heavy stone strapped to his ankles. He set out across the rolling hills, seeking something he couldn't yet define. 1 week later. Mortis was nestled behind a steep, grassy rise, watching the caravan move slowly across the terrain. There were six wagons in total, all covered, drawn by a mix of hunchbacked horses, lowing cattle and mules. The latter were pulling the last cart, a pair of grey beasts that seemed to fight every step, requiring the lash of their master's whip. Children ran along the edges of the procession, laughing and playing. Women sat with their feet dangling from the backs of the carts, knitting or pressing their hands into bowls, kneading bread dough, perhaps. The men drove the horses, cattle, and mules. Other than the whips, Mortis couldn't make out any other weapons, though he was certain they would have knives at the least, and perhaps bows for hunting. But there were no swords, and none of them carried the wary look of soldiers. No, these were frontiersmen and women, off to seek a better life for their families. Had they been further south, perhaps they might have been on the road to Restor or one of the other travellers' villages. But this far north, and with their bearing directly to the east, there was only one possibility. These people wanted to cross Hyrule Lake and find Portage. Movement caught his attention to the west. His breath caught for a second, but then eased out as he realized it was another caravan, slightly larger and longer than the first. Behind that one was another, and another, the wagon stretching as far as the eye could see. Mortis knew these people. Not personally, but their type. For he was one of them. Dreamers. Freedom seekers. It was the same mentality that had made him save enough coin to board a ship across the Crimean Sea. They hated being under the thumb of a lord or lady, and the construction of a castle in Bethany had been enough to drive them from the growing city. By necessity, Mortis had fallen into the employ of the castle at Night's End, but he'd never felt comfortable there. If not for his daily escape into the woods, he wasn't sure he would have lasted as long in the position. "This is where I belong." The thought struck him hard in the chest, not only because of its trueness, but because of the pain that came along with it. Because of what, who, was missing. Perhaps he deserved to be alone. But perhaps not. He stood, crested the hill, and started toward the first caravan. 1 month later. Surrounded by people, kind, generous people, Mortis felt as alone as ever. They'd accepted him without pause, and though he'd felt their eyes appraising his bedraggled condition and the fact that he carried no supplies or luggage other than the clothes on his back, they'd never questioned him for it, lending him their own extra things, which he promised to repay through his labours around camp. There was Bairn, with his quick-to-smile face and litany of japes that always seemed on the tip of his tongue, and his wife, Naomi, with her own shrewd wit and ability to see into his thoughts and feelings with such accuracy it scared him. Their children should have brought him joy, Marcus and Violet and Otis, with their excess of energy and requests for rides on his broad shoulders. Five other families travelled with them, too, and they were all in the same category of good people. Rare people, these days at least. Mortis would smile sometimes, and even let a laugh slip now and again, but they never reached the core of him the way they used to, the way they always did with Scarlet. The tangle had been a pleasant surprise. From a distance, the thick forest had appeared gnarled and impenetrable, but as they entered the shadowy wood, the secret paths seemed to make themselves known to the weary travellers, and whenever they required sustenance, they would find a bush ripe with sweet berries, bursting with juice, or a tree dropping crunchy nuts. There was water aplenty as well, both from the diamond-clear streams and the occasional misting rains, which pooled from above in large purple cup-like leaves that grew throughout the wood. They'd even been able to bring their caravans and horses through, something they hadn't expected. If Mortis didn't know better, he'd say the tangle was magical. Still, despite all that, Mortis waged a daily battle with the urge to slip away without a goodbye. Because all the goodness he'd experienced since his harried flight through the western woods only reminded him of all the goodness he'd lost. Not the goodness, the bestness. How did one go on when the very best part of them had been stripped away? How did one move forward when the current life felt but a pale shade of their former? Mortis gritted his teeth and took another step. One foot in front of the other, that was how. Ahead of him, there was a shout from one of the children. It wasn't an unusual sound, for they shouted about every new discovery, from the colourful four-winged butterflies as large as dinner plates, to the holes they found in several of the trees that were like strange looking-glasses into another world, a bleak and desolate place, devoid of anything but wind and stone. But this was a different sound, echoing from not only child to child, but from adult to adult, the excitement palpable in the tone of each cry. Mortis quickened his pace, because he needed a new distraction, something to take his mind off anything but the great unknown of the future. Ahead, the wood finally ended. A lake spread out before them, its surface rippling slightly as a current dragged fallen leaves left to right, downstream, where they would eventually flow into the spear and, finally, the burning sea. Mortis wondered if he would float that far if he eased himself into the water, dipping his head back into the current, closing his eyes. Could he float forever? The mirthful cries of splashing and play drew him from his reverie. It wasn't just the children, but their parents, too, plunging into the water, clothes and all. Mortis could hear the baying of hounds, the shouts of pursuit. He could feel his own soaked clothes sucking at his skin as he fought the current. He could remember the exact moment when he noticed his hands were clean again, no longer blood-stained. "Morty?" a voice said, and he snapped his head to the side, surprised. "I told you not to call me that," he said automatically. Bairn chuckled, the corners of his eyes crinkling. Though he wasn't old, he bore laugh lines aplenty, even when he wasn't laughing. His hair was sandy, just the edges tipped with grey. He wore a brown travelling cloak that covered most of his short, rotund form.
"Mortis sounds so stiff?"
It was an old joke, but the perpetually amused man never seemed to tire of it. Occasionally, Mortis would laugh, but he couldn't manage it today. Not even a thin smile. Instead, he looked back at the water, his eyes tracing a path to the opposite side, where a series of small structures arose. Ant-like forms moved amongst them. People. Portage, Mortis thought. We made it. There were several wooden docks nestled against the shore, mirrored on this side as well. Boats shoved off from them, ferrying across. More colonists must arrive every day.
"Are you okay?"
Bairn asked, his own smile fading. Mortis had told them nothing of his past, only that he was a woodcutter, but not that he'd been in the employ of the castle at night's end. History was dangerous, even amongst friends, and he had no idea how to answer such a simple question. "I am trying," was all he could manage. Bairn nodded, as if he understood the layers behind the vague three-word answer.
"Aye, we all are. And that's what counts, isn't it?"
Given the man's propensity for humour, it always surprised Mortis when he turned from mirth to seriousness in the blink of an eye. "Is it?" There was a twinkle in the man's dark green eyes.
"Honestly? I don't rightly know."
Bairn did smile this time, genuinely, because he didn't either. He wondered whether it was true of all humans, even those who appeared confident and untouchable on the outside, men like Lord Farley Loren.
"You're not going to do anything foolish, are you?"
Bairn asked now. There was a lightness in his tone that belied the caring the statement implied. "Like swim with my clothes on," he said, gesturing to the others. Bairn smirked.
"Good point."
He threw his cloak aside and began tugging at his shirt, his pale round belly popping free like a broken button. By the time he was down to his underclothes, he was already stumbling toward the water, leaping into the air and smacking down with a cringeworthy slap that displaced enough water that Mortis feared he would drain the lake. He tried to laugh. He tried. Instead, he watched the first of several boats growing closer and closer as they skated across the lake. 1 month later. Portage was a place full of challenges, as was any new colony. Providing enough food for the ever-growing population, constructing shelters, digging privies. Mortis threw himself into the work, making the daily voyage across the lake, loading his boat with wood from the tangle to use for fuel and timber. At first he'd borrowed an axe, a fine tool lent by one of the primary builders for the burgeoning village. But upon seeing Mortis's level of production, the man had given it to him freely. Mortis felt the weight of it every day as it hung from his belt. The memories no longer assaulted him the way they had, but he still awoke, soaked in sweat in the middle of the night. Thankfully, he never recalled the nightmares, and he'd learned to control his thoughts. "This is my fresh start," he thought, as he hauled the boat toward the lake. No new colonists had arrived for several days, and the surface of the water was so undisturbed it might have been the silver span of an enormous mirror, reflecting the fluffy white clouds crossing the bluest sky Mortis had ever seen. And yet, nothing felt right. He jolted to a stop, unable to breathe, dropping the boat, sinking to his knees, feeling the hard line of his axe digging into his hip. He gasped and heaved, and watched tears.